You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 191 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Understanding Society Through Spiritual Scientific Knowledge, Social Threefolding, Christ, Lucifer, and Ahriman. 15 lectures, translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 14, given in Dornach on the 14th of November, 1919. From the last few lectures, you will have seen how we come to a kind of illusory idea about the external world, and how, in fact, what is usually seen as the natural world is inwardly dependent on humanity itself. We can only acquire a true outlook on the world by seeing the earth, the world, altogether, in its totality. In other words, by recognizing that the human being belongs intrinsically to it, and that our reciprocal relationship with the world must invariably be taken into account. Otherwise, we always arrive at an abstraction without essence, a merely abstract understanding of the mineral, and at most also of the plant and animal kingdoms, although the latter two no longer properly figure in our modern view of nature. In speaking of the natural world today, people are really only considering the mineral world, to which is appended this brief tale called history, as a quite different kind of truth. This outlook, which does not really encompass the human being, is one that we must slowly begin to depart from in our time. We have seen from many different perspectives why we should depart from the worldview that has emerged, by a kind of necessity, over the last 3 to 4 centuries. Today I will only mention that human beings in their outward knowledge, their outward perceptions, are increasingly becoming dependent on their physical body and its imperatives, unless they seek to contribute to their own development by bringing forth a higher knowledge that requires their active will. In future, either humanity will succumb to the kind of worldview acquired by, one can say, staying as one is by birth, gaining no other ideas and concepts than those into which one grows naturally through birth and ordinary education, as it usually is today. Or else people will depart from their belief that anything worth knowing is innate in human nature as a given, that reality can be judged by these standards, instead of creating a true human evolution as prefigured in natural, in spiritual science. That would be the other path, and one that humanity will have to pursue if the earth is not to decline and degenerate. In a sense, we can also regard what I have just said in geographical terms, in which case it acquires a special meaning for the present time. If we go far enough back in earthly evolution, we find that the human being is not rooted in terrestrial existence as such. As you know, and as I have described in my title Occult Science and Outline, the human being underwent a long process of evolution prior to earthly existence. You know that humanity was then withdrawn again into a purely spiritual existence, and from this descended in turn to earth existence. Now, it is the case, in fact, that the human being took with him in this descent into earth existence a widespread primordial wisdom, kind of inherited wisdom, if you like, a wisdom which was by nature single and unified for all humanity. You can find more details about this in my lecture series titled The Mission of the Folk Souls, given in Christiania, Oslo. So, this inherited wisdom was a unified endowment. In speaking of knowledge, in quotes here, I do not mean only what is called so in science, but everything that we can assimilate into our soul world as a vision of our surroundings and our life. And now, this primordial wisdom became more specific and localized, differing depending on the diverse regions of the earth. If you survey the cultures of the diverse peoples of the earth, and you can do this all the better if you draw on various aspects of our spiritual science that relate to this, you can discover that in different nations and races, knowledge was different from time immemorial. You can distinguish in this way between Indian, Chinese, Japanese, and European culture. And within European culture, in turn, there are different specific nuances, and then also American culture, and so forth. And if you ask how the original, inherited primordial wisdom increasingly diversified in this way, you will find this was due to the inner disposition and nature of each race. But essentially, we always find adaptations of these inner conditions in different peoples to the outer conditions of the earth. And we get at least a picture of diversification if we try to find the connection between what is, say, Indian culture and the climatic and geographical character of the Indian subcontinent. Likewise, we gain an idea of the specific nature of Russian culture if we consider how the Russian is connected with his region of the earth. But now we can also say that in relation to these geographical conditions, as in many other respects, modern humanity is currently in a kind of crisis. This dependency of the human being on his region gradually grew to the greatest conceivable proportions in the 19th century, although it is also true to say that people emancipated themselves from their regions in their minds. And yet, this meant they became, paradoxically, all the more dependent on them. We can see this if we compare, say, how an ancient Greek related to ancient Greece, and how a modern Englishman or German relates to his regions. The Greeks still had much of the primordial wisdom in their culture, in their education. They were, perhaps physically, more strongly dependent on their Greek territory than modern people are dependent on their territory today. But this stronger dependency was relieved, assuaged, by the inner primordial wisdom with which they were filled. Humanity gradually lost sight of this primordial knowledge. We can show quite clearly how direct comprehension of certain primordial wisdoms faded around the mid-15th century, and how even traditional vestiges of it slowly dried up in the 19th century. Rather, like plants in greenhouses, the primordial wisdoms were still preserved artificially in all kinds of secret societies, which sometimes used them for very bad purposes. These secret societies preserved the original wisdom in the 19th century. It was somewhat different in the 18th century, in a way comparable to hothouse plants. It is an apt metaphor, for the Freemason symbols in use today are related to the primordial wisdom from which they originate, precisely as hothouse plants relate to their growing freely in nature. Actually, the Freemason symbols are less connected with their origins than are artificially bred plants with their natural habitats. Precisely by losing their inner immersion in primordial wisdom, though, human beings become fully dependent on their geographical regions. If they were not to regain a freely developed store of spiritual truths, people across the globe would become entirely differentiated according to these territories and regions. Here, in fact, we can distinguish three types that we have already distinguished in other ways. We can say that if spiritual scientific impulses do not become widespread in the world, from the West, only commercial and economic truths would spread and become dominant, from which in turn various other truths can spring. But economic thinking, economic and commercial ideas would hold sway. And from the East would spread essentially spiritual truths. Asia would increasingly become confined to spiritual truths, albeit very decadent ones. And Central Europe would tend to cultivate the intellectual realm. The intellect would become particularly dominant here, connected with some of the tradition of ancient times and with both economic and commercial truths born over from the West and spiritual truths born over from the East. But people living within these three main regions of the earth would increasingly become specifically oriented to each tendency. In our world today, there is certainly a general trend toward dominance of such specialization. I beg you to take this very, very seriously. If spiritual science did not make inroads into the world, the East would gradually become quite incapable of running its own economy, of developing economic thinking. The East would only be able to engage in production, that is, to directly cultivate the soil, to create and process natural produce by means of tools supplied by the West. And all economic activities, governed by human reason, would develop in the West. From this perspective, the recent catastrophe of the Great War is nothing other than the beginning of the tendency toward commercial penetration of the East by the West. That is, toward making the East into a region in which people labor, while the West becomes a region of commercial and economic activity, drawing on what the East produces from nature through labor. Here, we do not need to set a precise boundary between East and West, since this will be variable. If the currently prevailing tendency were to continue, and if it were not imbued by spirit, there is no doubt, just speaking hypothetically, that the whole of the East would succumb to commercial exploitation by the West. And this course of evolution would be regarded as inevitable for humanity on Earth, would be seen as entirely just and inevitable. There is no other way of preventing half of humankind becoming slaves, and the other half exploiters of this slavery, than once again to imbue the earth with a spirituality that all must work together to achieve. Such ideas are easily rejected nowadays. People are all too inclined to brush them aside, simply because it will make their outward lives uncomfortable to face actual reality. People think that even if commercial exploitation of the East occurs, it will take so long that they will no longer be there to see it. Those with children may be more concerned for the sake of their offspring, but they prefer to bury their head in the sand a little with the idea that better times will surely come and such like. A love of ease means that very few people indeed concern themselves in their inmost being with the fact that shaping humanity's future in a way worthy of human dignity will only be achieved by spreading not only commerce but spirit through the world. We can say that the cultural life of humanity has acquired its present configuration from three directions. And it is extraordinarily interesting to contemplate these three aspects of earthly culture for a moment. especially in relation to the task we have set ourselves in these lectures. You see, if we survey the earth from the east toward the west, we must say this. Everything humanity possesses as a certain foundation of ethical and moral truths comes from the Orient. The form in which the Orient once developed its ethical principles alongside a general worldview, the form of a general cosmology, and so on, has been lost. But what has remained is a residue of Oriental thinking and feeling, is a certain ethical science. With this in mind, try reading the talks given by Rabindranath Tagore, collected under the title Nationalism. You will see that they scarcely contain anything of the wise teachings that once lived in human souls in the East, but they are extraordinarily interesting. And if you read these talks by Tagore, you will find that none of it, the whole ethos of the talks, could have been spoken without the underlying, albeit no longer conscious, primordial wisdom of Asia. These talks are filled, and this is even their chief feature, with a moral pathos, an ethical will, an austere moral critique directed at the whole individual mechanism of the West, and its still worse political mechanism. The ethical truths that reverberate from the East when people such as Tagore speak are imbued through and through with a wisdom drawn from the stars. If you set aside all prejudice and examine with an open mind everything that has developed as culture and education here in Central Europe and the West, you are compelled to acknowledge that everything of this kind living here, whether uttered by philosophers or non-philosophers, by the simplest people or the most educated, all ethical and moral views, now deeply instinctive in people in the central and western regions of the world, originally filtered through from Asia, from the Orient. The Orient is really the true home of ethics, of ethos. If we look toward the West, whose culture has, one can say, unfurled before historical eyes, we see how a more rational, intellectual approach to world phenomena comes into play and is related to the utilitarian principle. There is a great contrast of which humanity ought to be aware between the pathos living in the speeches of Tagore and in everything developed in the West as the utilitarian principle. If we speak radically, we will have to say that an outlook such as that of John Stuart Mill or Bergson in philosophy or Adam Smith in economics is something entirely alien to an Asian mind, even if he tries to understand it. He can regard it as an interesting fact that human beings say such things, but he will never be tempted to draw forth from within him such things as these, with their focus on outward human utility. The Asian fundamentally despises the nature of European and American thinking, because it always presents him with a utilitarian standpoint, which can only be governed by the intellect, by the rational mind. And thus it is that modes of thinking connected with the idea of utility have chiefly arisen in the West. Earlier I pointed out that primordial wisdom diversified across the globe in the different peoples of the earth. And so now we can distinguish the major types, the ethical type in the East, in the Orient, the intellectual utilitarian type in the Occident, the West. And between them, the third type keeps trying to squeeze through, to emerge, the aesthetic type, as I will call it. The aesthetic type is as inherent to Central Europe as the ethical type is to the Orient and the utilitarian intellectual type to the Occident. We need only recall one phenomenon to offer outward proof, also, of how the aesthetic type of human being seeks to emerge in Central Europe specifically. At the same time as the French Revolution was raging in the West, bringing both devastating results and fruitful outcomes, and the East was wrapped in spiritual dreams, we find Schiller, for example, writing his title, Letters on the Aesthetic Education of Man. These relate directly to the French Revolution, but they seek to solve the problem thrown up politically by the French Revolution in purely humanistic human terms. They seek to establish the human being as free in a purely inward sense. And it is interesting that the whole mode of reflection in Schiller's aesthetic letters is founded firstly on rejecting the intellectualism of a purely utilitarian perspective, but secondly also on dismissing a merely ethical standpoint. You see, the ethical standpoint was one which had also been rationalized and intellectualized at a certain point. Everything in the world passes through diverse metamorphoses and then appears in a different form. Thus, the ethical standpoint of the Orient is certainly not at all intellectual. And yet one can comprehend it in intellectual terms, can intellectualize or Kantianize it. Kant first formulated the following fine statement, quote, Duty, you great and lofty name, comprehending within you nothing arbitrary, nothing self-ingratiating, but demanding subjection, close quote. He means subjection to ethical values. But Schiller, by contrast, says, quote, Gladly I serve my friend, but forgive me, through my own inclination. And often I'm troubled to think that therefore I am lacking in all virtue. Close quote. As a true Central European, Schiller could not accept this Kantian intellectualization of ethics. For him, a person was not wholly human if he must first subject himself to duty to fulfill his duty. He thought full humanity meant feeling an inner inclination to do what is ethically worthwhile. And so he rejected the ethical rigor of Kant. But he equally dismissed the purely intellectual principle of authority and saw in the conjuring forth of beauty and its enjoyment, and thus in the human being's aesthetic conduct, the highest free expression of human nature. One can say that he wrote his aesthetic letters as a description of the person of Goethe. Schiller started from a sense of envy and inner antipathy toward Goethe, and had to wrestle with himself before he succeeded in acknowledging him. You may say that there was a time in Schiller's life when any talk of Goethe tasted bitter to him. But then they became acquainted, and not only developed mutual respect, but learned to immerse themselves in each other's being. And then, as a spiritual biography, a spiritual characterization of Goethe, Schiller wrote his title Letters on the Aesthetic Education of Man. Everything contained in these letters could never have been written if Goethe had not modeled for Schiller what they convey. At the beginning of their friendship on 23 August 1794, Schiller wrote the letter to Goethe, which I have often cited, quote, For a long while now, albeit from some way off, I have observed the progress of your mind, close quote. And now he describes Goethe as the mind or spirit who is in reality a resurrected Greek. And so we see how he connects here with ancient Greece and the first dawning of the aesthetic spirit of Central Europe. And in Goethe we see someone working his way from the most intellectual element through to an acknowledgement of truth, which is encompassed as much through art as through science. If you trace how Goethe studied the ethics of Spinoza with Herder, then traveled to Italy, and in letters home wrote of how in works of art he regarded as emerging from a Greek spirit, he saw necessity, saw God. We can say that the intellectualism of Spinoza becomes aesthetic experience on his Italian journey through sight of these works of art. And Goethe bears witness to the fact that the ancient Greeks, in creating their works of art, proceeded by the same laws as nature employs, laws which he believes he is slowly discovering. In other words, Goethe does not think that when one creates a work of art, one is creating something fantastical, and that only science is strictly true. No. Goethe thought that true art contains the deeper truth of nature's essence. Thus his outlook was aesthetic. And we can put it like this: Occident, intellectual, utilitarian. The central regions of the world, aesthetic. The Orient, ethics and morality. And it is certainly correct to say that wherever ethical truths have arisen, whether in the East, the Center, or in the West, they originated in the East. And wherever utilitarian truths emerge, in the Center or in the East, they actually originated in the West. Beauty, aesthetics originate from the Center. Everywhere we can trace in this way the source of these three elements in human life, sometimes in very minute detail. Look, if karma has determined that someone should found anthroposophy in Central Europe, then something of Goethe's belief that ultimately the same element as lives in art is also the element of truth must live within this anthroposophy. The same element that comes to expression in painting and sculpture, even in architecture, also inevitably lives in the thought edifice of truth. Indeed, one must, as I tried to do in the first chapter of my title, Philosophy of Freedom, which has become the last chapter in the new edition, say that the philosopher, the human being who founds a worldview, must be an artist in concepts. Such an idea is generally dismissed, but there I had to accept and acknowledge it. All this springs from a unified spirit. In consequence, all ideas one expresses acquire such hues and complexions. But then people write books, such as the recently published pamphlet by Amy Blech, containing all sorts of malicious, intentionally malicious slander. She writes, for instance, that what I present as anthroposophy contains some fine or beautiful things, but it is at odds with the clarity of the French spirit. Certainly it opposes intellectualism, a prosaic, rhetorical formulation of concepts. Such people prefer to be presented with coarsely palpable ideas, copied from the material world, since these can be grasped in more clearly defined outline. Yes, we can pursue these things in detail. I could present to you the small details of matters that would illustrate what I have now painted with a larger brush. But the detailed instance I have cited is sufficient and is extraordinarily interesting. It is important to recognize that ethics and art and intellectualism are not simply all produced in the West. No, indeed. Art is drawn from the world's central regions, ethics from the Orient, and to these is added the intellectual or utilitarian element. Similarly, a kind of aesthetic element is cultivated in the center, and everything that was incorporated into this aesthetic element, especially in the 19th century, came over from the West. It would be interesting to write a history of biology from this perspective. If you read Goethe's ideas on metamorphosis, you can find a magnificent theory of evolution there, but the West will always regard it as aesthetically contaminated. In the 19th century, when the whole globe became dependent on the West, the Western element of Darwinism came to pervade evolutionary ideas. It introduced into them the utilitarian perspective, ideas of expediency. Utility is completely absent from Goethe's teachings, since he is imbued with aestheticism. In future, people should not refuse to accept anything from each other, but embrace it all, in the same way that, as I described earlier, they are economically differentiated. If they refuse to do so, globally we would find a certain ethos spreading across Asia, such as that embodied in the fiery words of Rabindranath Tagore. While in Central Europe, somewhat differently, a certain principle of, quote, beyond good and evil, close quote, would become current, a kind of voguish, dandified Nietzschean outlook, an aestheticizing of everything, even moral ideas. Especially toward the end of the 19th century, we saw the victorious rise of aestheticism there. And meanwhile, the merely utilitarian perspective would be unstoppable in the West. Intellectual cleverness in the utilitarian outlook, an echo of the spiritual element in ideas of utility. The only possible remedy is for human beings to be pervaded by a truly spiritual element, though this will, of course, require them to accord full seriousness to this spiritual element, will necessitate developing the will to see things as they appear today to anyone who really tries to keep an open mind. This catastrophe of the war has drawn some very remarkable things to the surface, including phenomena that are in part very uncomfortable, but on the other hand instructive. Let me describe one such phenomenon. You see, in modern German literature, hardly a week goes by, you can barely keep up with it, without someone or other expounding, I was about to say evacuating, on their views of the war and political events. We have read what has been thought by the heads, I say expressly heads rather than minds, of people like Jagow, Bethmann, Tirpitz, and Ludendorff. Michaelis, as far as I am aware, has spared us his thoughts so far. On the one hand, it is unpleasant to read all this stuff, and yet it is also extremely interesting. It is extremely interesting from the following perspective. You see, we can find that books such as the one by Bethmann or the one by Tirpitz approach matters from completely opposite viewpoints. But what does the viewpoint matter here? It is sometimes just to do with how the good Lord has belabored them for a while. Bethmann has been subject to his probing eye, EYE, and Tirpitz to the heel of his boar, and afterwards they have different viewpoints. So we need not worry about the viewpoint. This is of much less importance than observing the spirit that lives in such writings. We can first of all do the following. I myself undertook the experiment. After I'd allowed the very turbid gravy of these texts, this Bethmann and Tirpitz gravy, to work their effect upon me, I tried to read a series of essays by Hermann Grimm. Essays that are very dear to me, which non-Germans, however, would consider chauvinistically German. But that again is just a point of view, with which I am not concerned now. What I am considering here is the spirit living in a text. At first view, we can ask how the spirit, the mode of thinking, the inner constituents of this Bethmann-Tirpitz gravy, relate to what lives in the, if you like, political observations of Hermann Grimm. And it has to be said that Goethe was alive for Hermann Grimm, a living presence for him, and had not lived in vain. But the same cannot be said about Tirpitz or Bethmann. For them, Goethe was not present. I'm not saying they haven't read him. It might have been wiser for them not to read him, for he simply did not exist for them. What you read in these books strikes me initially as if written by a medieval foot soldier, and to possess their kind of logic. Ludendorff's logic is particularly interesting. This is the man who performed the great service of helping get Lenin transported through Germany to Russia in his sealed train. So we can see him as the real importer of Bolshevism into Russia. He does not have the effrontery to deny this completely in his book, although he has effrontery enough in other ways. He says this. It was a military necessity to get Lenin to Russia. But the political leaders should have averted the grave consequences of this and failed to do so. That is the logic of these gentlemen. And yet, I certainly do not want to suggest that Clemenceau possessed superior logic. Please do not think I am partisan here in any way. The logic of Lloyd George and Wilson was no better either, though in their case, this was not so glaringly obvious. Well, this is what one first discovers. But then it continues, and you find, if you look for an historical comparison, that you have to go a fairly long way back. A curious similarity exists between the mode of thinking practiced by Tirpitz and Ludendorff and that of cultural authorities in Rome in the first and second pre-Christian centuries. If you try to uncover an intimate commonality of soul here, it is as if the mode of thinking of ancient pre-Christian Rome surfaced again in these people, and as if everything since, including Christianity, even if those gentlemen seem to speak of Christ and such like, never occurred. You see, it is often thought that saying the Luciferic element has remained behind residually in humanity refers only to non-mundane matters. But in the world itself, this principle of residual presence exists very emphatically. One can say that the pre-Caesarian grandees of ancient Rome have reappeared in such people. And everything else that has happened in Europe since does not really exist for them. People ought to recognize this fully. It ought to be observed. Only then can we establish for ourselves a free perspective adequate for evaluating the modern era. Great demands today are placed upon the human capacity for judgment. All this must be said when speaking of the need to penetrate these times of ours with spiritual impulses. From a superficial perspective, it is easy to say this. Yes, of course, we must introduce spiritual impulses into our era. But it is not so simple to actually do this. You need only consider if, wherever spiritual impulses have made some headway, they have also produced desirable fruits. At the end of the day, the following has to be said. If you think of certain pamphlets that have been written by adherents of anthroposophy of many years' standing, even pamphlets in which the spiritual science figuring here is properly conveyed to the world, these things are nevertheless turned on their heads. These are plants that have grown from the soil, where efforts have been made to cultivate spirit and communicate it to humankind. But it would be naive to think that we have got beyond a stage where supposed adherents of our movement turn upside down the spiritual truths that have been communicated. This is still going on. It is not nearly as easy as one might think to count on spiritual truths being disseminated amongst humanity. You see, the nature of humanity today has a tendency to differentiate itself into the three types I characterized, the ethical, the aesthetic, and the intellectual, but then to further diversify within each of these. Now, spiritual truths will, by their nature, not be assimilated fully by people intrinsically specialized and differentiated in this way. It is quite impossible for people differentiated in these ways, and in others too, to take up spiritual truths cleanly. In quotes. Remember that people everywhere today are tending to encapsulate themselves within national chauvinisms. Indeed, if you wish to absorb generally human and spiritual truths, but still retain your nationalist chauvinism, you will turn them into their opposite. It is actually impossible today to communicate things that it would, from a certain perspective, be desirable to communicate. And this is due to the differentiation I am speaking of. And so we have to awaken people's interest by approaching them from perspectives that have already formed and exist. We have to relate to what already exists, but at the same time to recognize that human beings today are tending to distance themselves from ancient inherited wisdom and have nothing to replace it with but regional, territorial differences across the globe. And so it will not work to disseminate spiritual wisdoms amongst humanity without at the same time spreading a certain ethos. Many people have read the book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds. These books are being widely read at present. And those who read them find that the first advice they offer is ethical in nature, and that in ethical terms, this attracts the reader's full approval. Yes, the first advice they encounter must be ethical in nature, and it must offer an essence of the best ethos of earthly culture. But on the other hand, it is also necessary to cultivate a certain artistic element. Within the anthroposophic movement, this led to very great difficulties, since there was a certain disinclination for artistic things. People strove instead for an abstract, neutral symbolism. And still today there are movements that regard themselves as theosophical, which reject all art. It was good destiny, good karma for our movement, therefore, that we also embarked on artistic efforts here in Dornach, and were able to elaborate them from the abstract symbolic element. If it had been up to some, we might have been looking now at many black crosses everywhere, bearing seven rose-like splodges on them as profound symbols of our building. Naturally, we had to resist this symbolic character, had to seek to create out of the artistic element. We must, therefore, connect with the best tradition, if impulses can be called tradition, of human culture. And above all, we must consider that these things are profound and serious truths, and that they sound like this. Whoever seeks true knowledge must cultivate a sense of truth. When we speak radically of this, we touch on something that many find extremely objectionable, for rigorous contemplation of truth is highly uncomfortable for many people today. In life, they try to prettify it. But untruth, even if untrue only through sentimentality, does not accord with real dedication to the truths which, for instance, seek to enter the world through anthroposophy. In this respect, the churches have sinned greatly. The various confessions have bred a state of affairs irreconcilable with a full and pure sense of truth. Certain types of piety have been introduced into the world which flatter human egoism more than they accord with the human sense for truth. And this is why it is so necessary to attend to cultivating inner truthfulness, something highlighted in many places in anthroposophic writings. Life itself today demands much untruth of people, and there are two clear tendencies, really, which produce in humankind a reluctance to accept the truth of reality. Today there is a tendency to characterize things according to personal predilection rather than as reality itself dictates. Nowadays, and in another context, I have been compelled to refer to this in public often recently. People are acclaimed as practical or pragmatic when they adopt a certain intransigent routine and work in their field with a degree of ruthlessness, rejecting everything that does not serve their view of regimented endeavor. From this standpoint, people are distinguished either as practical or as dreamers. The dire consequences of these things became apparent during the 19th century and into our own time, with a degree of world historical untruthfulness. Until the catastrophe of this world war broke out, this great trial that came upon us, it was actually difficult to characterize these matters in a forthright way. But I am about to publish a collection of essays I wrote in the 80s and 90s of the last century, and they show how efforts had to be made at the time to cast a chink of light, at least, on certain truths. One of these essays, entitled Bismarck, the Successful Politician, sought to show that the success of this individual was based on the fact that he never really saw any further than a few steps in front of his nose. Back then, there was no point in publishing such things, since scarcely anyone could accept them. Now, though, there is more of a basis for saying these things, since many lessons can be learned from the catastrophic war. Most people, of course, fail to learn from events. They have a certain store of views which they do not change. They cannot grasp at all what it means to learn from reality. Whenever I take people on a tour of our building here, I tell them that if I were to design such a building a second time, I would do it differently. I would certainly never do it again in the same way. This is not to find any fault with the building, but I myself would never reproduce it again exactly, since one must always learn from what has been done and from the reality before you. This morning, to my dismay, I read a Field Marshal Hindenburg's comment that if he were to wage this war again, he would do so exactly as he did previously. People read such things, but overlook the need to learn the bitter lessons of the war, and thus gain understanding of the times we live in. Whatever messages we receive from the world, and I mean also through reading, we should examine accordingly, and recognize that revising our views of important matters is necessary, indispensable. Up until the outbreak of war, there was a seeming outward justification in regarding Bismarck as a pragmatic man. Hermann Grimm considered him a tower of practicality, but the catastrophic war has shown him to be a fantasist. Founding the empire was, of course, a fantasy. I'm trying to make clear that life itself can and must reveal human illusions, also in the moral and historical realm. Last Sunday I showed that it is illusory to regard the natural world as distinct from humanity, as scientists assume, and that we must recognize how humanity participates in what occurs in the natural context. Thus, the scientific view of nature can be a tissue of illusions. Today I was trying to show how we must allow our views to be corrected by the facts of the history and the realities of life, since, for long periods, things often only reveal their outward and seeming nature. Today, we often find that individuals, regarded as eminently practical, are in fact fantasists, and we must accustom ourselves to revising the way we see things. There is plenty of opportunity to do so today, and likewise a great need for it. Our outlook will only truly accord with the anthroposophical movement, if we see that we must revise our judgments, sometimes in the most important matters. Judgments about nature can usually be revised in the light of spiritual science itself. Judgments about life can only be revised if we really develop in ourselves the outlook and ethos we need for the anthroposophic movement. The end of Lecture 14.